Chapter 23. Jurisfiction Session Number 40320. Snell was buried in the text C. It was invited guests only, so although Havisham went, I did not. Both Perkins's and Snell's place would be taken by B2 Generics, who had been playing them for a while in tribute books. The copies you usually find in cheaply printed Book of the Month choices. As they lowered Snell's body into the sea to be reduced to letters, the bellman tingled his bell and spoke a short eulogy for both of them. Havisham said it was very moving. But the most ironic part of it was that the entire Perkins and Snell detective series was finally to be offered as a boxed set, and neither of them ever knew. Thursday next, the Jurisfiction Chronicles. I felt tired and washed out the following morning. Gran was still fast asleep, snoring loudly with Pickwick on her lap when I got up. I made a cup of coffee and was sitting at the kitchen table flicking through a copy of Movable Type and feeling grotty, when there was a gentle rap at the door. I looked up too quickly and my head throbbed.
"Yes?"
I called.
"It's Dr. Fnorp. I teach Lola and Randolph."
I opened the door, checked his ID and let him in. A tall man, he seemed quite short and was dark-haired, although on occasion seemed blonde. He spoke with a notable accent from nowhere at all, and he had a limp, or perhaps not. He was a generic's generic. All things to all people. "Coffee?"
"Thank you,"
he said, adding, "Aha," when he saw the article I had been reading. "Every year there are more categories." He was referring to the Bookworld Awards, which had, I noted, been sponsored by Ultraword.
"Dopiest Shakespearean character," he read. "Othello should win that one hands down. Are you going to the bookies?"
"I've been asked to present one. Being the newest jurisfiction member affords one that privilege, apparently."
"Oh, it's the first year all the generics will be going. We've had to give them a day off college."
"What can I do for you?"
"Well, Lola has been late every day this week. Constantly talks in class, leads the other girls astray, smokes, swears, and was caught operating a distillery in the science block. She has little respect for authority and has slept with most of her male classmates."
"That's terrible. What shall we do?"
"Do?" replied Fnorp. "We aren't going to do anything. Lola has turned out admirably, so much so that we've got her a leading role in Girls Make All the Moves, a 30-something romantic comedy novel. No, I'm really here because I'm worried about Randolph."
"I see. What's the problem?"
"Well, he's just not taking his studies very seriously. He's not stupid. I could make him an A4 if only he'd pay a little more attention. Those good looks of his are probably his downfall. Age 50-something and what we call a distinguished grey archetype. I think he feels he doesn't need any depth, that he can get away with a good descriptive passage at introduction and then do very little.
And this is a problem because..."
"I just want something a bit better for him,"
sighed Dr. Fnorp, who clearly had the best interest of his students at heart.
"He's failed his B-grade exams twice. Once more and he'll be nothing but an incidental character with a line or two, if he's lucky."
"Perhaps what he wants. There isn't enough room for all characters to be A-grade."
"That's what's wrong with the system," said Fnorp bitterly. "If incidental characters had more depth, the whole of fiction would be a lot richer. I want my students to enliven even the C-grade parts."
I got the point. Even from my relative ignorance, I could see the importance of fully rounded characters. Trouble was, for budgetary reasons, the Council of Genres had pursued a policy of minimum characterization requirements for generics for more than 30 years.
"They fear rebellion," he said quietly. "The C of G want generics to stay stupid. An unsophisticated population is a compliant one. But it's at the cost of the book world."
"So what do you want me to do?"
"Well," sighed Fnorp, finishing his coffee, "have a word with Randolph and see what you can do. Try to find out why he is being so intransigent."
I told him I would and saw him out the door. I found Randolph asleep back in his own bed. He was clutching his pillow. Lola had gone out early to meet some friends. A photo of her was on the bedside table next to him, and he snored quietly to himself. I crept back to the door and banged on it.
"Whizz," said a sleepy voice.
"I need to run one of the engines," I told him. "Can you give me a hand?" There was a thump as he fell out of bed. I smiled to myself and took my coffee up to the flight deck. Mary had told me to run the No. 3 engine periodically, and left instructions on how to do so in the form of a checklist. I didn't know how to fly, but did know a thing or two about engines, and needed an excuse to talk to Randolph. I sat in the pilot's seat and looked along the wing to the engine. The cowlings were off and the large radial was streaked with oil and grime. It never rained here, which was just as well, although things didn't actually age either, so it didn't matter if it did. I consulted the checklist in front of me. The engine would have to be turned by hand to begin with, and I didn't really fancy this, so got a slightly annoyed Randolph out on the wing.
"How many times?"
he asked, turning the engine by way of a crank inserted through the cowling. "Twice should do," I called back, and 10 minutes later he returned, hot and sweaty with the exertion.
"What do we do now?"
he asked, suddenly a lot more interested. Starting big radial engines was quite a boy thing, after all. "You read it out," I said, handing him the checklist.
"Master fuel on, ignition switches off," he read.
"Done.
Prop controls fully up and throttle 1 inch open."
I wrestled with the appropriate levers from a small nest that sprouted from the center console.
"Done. I had Dr. Fnorp round this morning."
"Gills are set to open and mixture at idle cutoff." "What did that old fart have to say for himself?"
I set the gills and pulled back the mixture lever. "He said he thought you could do a lot better than you had been. What's next?"
"Switch on the fuel booster pump until the warning light goes out."
"Where do you think that is?" We found the fuel controls in an awkward position above our heads and to the rear of the flight deck. Randolph switched on the booster pumps.
"I don't want to be a featured character," he said. "I'll be quite happy working as a mature elder male mentor figure or something. There is call for one in Girls Make All the Moves."
"Isn't that the novel Lola will be working in?"
"Is it?"
he said, feigning ignorance badly.
"I had no idea."
"Okay," I said as the fuel pressure warning light went out. "Now what?"
"Set the selector switch to the required engine and operate the priming pump until the delivery pipes are full."
I pumped slowly, the faint smell of aviation spirit filling the air. "What's this love-hate thing between you and Lola?"
"Oh, that's all well over," he said dismissively. "She's seeing some guy over at the Heroes Advanced Classes."
I stopped pumping as the handle met with some resistance. "We have fuel pressure. What's next?"
"Ignition and booster coil both on."
"Check.
Press starter and when engine is turning, operate the primer."
"Does that make sense?"
"Let's see."
I pressed the starter button and the prop slowly started to move. Randolph pumped the primer and there was a cough as the engine fired. Then another, this time accompanied by a large puff of black smoke from the exhaust. A few waders who were poking around in the shallows took flight as the engine appeared to die, then caught again and started to fire more regularly, the loud detonations transmitting through the airframe as a series of rumbles, growls and squeaks. I released the start button and Randolph stopped priming. The engine smoothed out. I switched to auto-rich and the oil pressure started to rise. I throttled back and smiled at Randolph, who grinned at me.
"Are you seeing anyone?"
I asked him.
"No."
He looked at me with his large eyes. When we had first met, he had been an empty husk, a blank face with no personality or features to call his own. Now he was a man of 50, but with the emotional insecurity of a 15-year-old.
"I can't imagine life without her Thursday," he suddenly burst out. "I think about her every second of every minute of every day."
"So tell her."
"And make myself look an idiot? She'd tell everyone at Tabula Rasa's. I'd be the laughingstock of them all."
"Who cares? Dr. Fnorp tells me it's affecting your work.
Do you want to end up as a walk-on part somewhere?
I really don't care, he said sadly. Without Lola, there isn't much of a future.
There'll be other generics.
Not like her. Always laughing and joking. When she's around, the sun shines and the birds sing.
He stopped and coughed, embarrassed at his admission.
You won't tell anyone I said all that stuff, will you?
He was smitten good and proper. Randolph, I said slowly, you have to tell her your feelings, even for your own sake. This will prey on your mind for years.
What if she laughs at me?
What if she doesn't? There's a good chance she actually quite likes you. Randolph's shoulders slumped.
I'll speak to her as soon as she gets back.
Good. I looked at my watch. I've got roll call in 20 minutes. Let the engine run for 10 minutes and then shut her down. I'll see you tonight.
Who are we waiting for? Asked the bellman. Godot, replied Benedict. Absent again? Anybody know where he is?
There was a mass shaking of heads. The bellman made a note in his book, tingled his bell, and cleared his throat.
Jurisfiction session number 40320 is now in session, he said in a voice tinged with emotion. Item 1. Perkins and Snell. Fine operatives who made the ultimate sacrifice for duty. Their names will be carved into the Bujah Memorial to live forever as inspiration for those who come after us. I call now for 2 minutes silence. Perkins and Snell. Perkins and Snell, we all repeated, and stood in silent memory of those lost. Thank you, said the bellman after 2 minutes had ticked by. Commander Bradshaw will be taking over the bestiary. Matthias's mayor has been contacted and asked me to say thank you to all those who sent tributes. The Perkins and Snell detective series will be taken over by B2 clones from the tribute book, and I know you will join me in wishing them the very best on their new venture.
He paused and took a deep breath.
These losses are a great shock to us all, and the lessons to be learned must not be ignored. We can never be too careful. Okay, item 2.
He turned over a page on his clipboard.
Investigation of Perkins's death. Commander Bradshaw, doesn't this come under your remit? Investigations are proceeding, replied Bradshaw slowly. There is no reason to suppose that their deaths were anything other than an accident. So what stops you closing the case? Because, replied Bradshaw,
trying to think of an excuse quickly.
Because, we still want to speak to Vernon Dean.
Dean is somehow involved? Asked the bellman.
Yes, perhaps. Interesting turn of events, said the bellman. Which brings us neatly on to item 3. I'm sorry to announce that Vernon Dean has been placed on the page runner's list.
There was a sharp intake of breath. Clasped as a page runner meant only one thing. Illegal activities.
We've known Vern since he was written, guys, and hard as it might be, we think he's done something pretty bad. Tweed, haven't you got something to say about this?
Harris Tweed stood up and cleared his throat. Vernon Dean is familiar to all of us. As the resident cad in the Squire of High Potenuse, he was well known for his cruelty towards the maidservant, who he ravages and then casts from the house. The maid returns 10 chapters later. But 3 days ago, the morning following Perkins' death, I might add, she didn't. He placed a picture of an attractive dark-haired woman on the board.
She's a C3 generic by the name of Mimi, 20 years old, identification code CDT/2511922. What did Dean say about her disappearance?
That's just it, replied Tweed grimly. He vanished at the same time. The Squire of Hypotenuse has been suspended pending further inquiries. It's been removed to the well and will stay there until Dean returns, if he returns.
Aren't you leaping to conclusions just a little bit early? Asked Havisham.
obviously concerned by the lack of objectivity in Tweed's report. Do we even have a motive?
We all liked Vern, said Tweed, me included. Despite being a villain in Potter News, he never gave us any cause for alarm. I was surprised by what I found, and you might be too.
He pulled a piece of paper from his top pocket and unfolded it.
This is a copy of a refusal by the Council of Genres Narrative Realignment Subcommittee to agree to Dean's application for an internal plot adjustment.
He pinned it on the board next to the picture of the maidservant.
In it, he requests for the maidservant to die in childbirth, thus saving his character from the traumatic scene at the end of chapter 28, when the maidservant turns up with the infant, now aged 6, to his wedding to Ellen O'Shaughnessy, the wealthy millowner's daughter. With the maidservant out of the way, he can marry O'Shaughnessy and not suffer the degrading slide into alcoholism and death that awaits him in chapter 32. I'm sorry to say that he had motive, Miss Havisham. He also had the opportunity, and the jurisfiction skills to cover his tracks.
There was silence as everyone took in the awful possibility of a jurisfiction agent gone bad. The only time it had happened before was when David Copperfield murdered Dora Spenlow so he could marry Agnes Wickfield.
"Did you search his book?"
asked Falstaff.
"Yes. We subjected the Squire of Hypotenuse to a word-by-word search, and we only found one person who was not meant to be there. A stowaway from Farquhar's previous book, Canon of Love, hiding in a cupboard in Potternews Hall. She was evicted back to her book."
"Have you tried the book-hounds?"
inquired the Red Queen, running a cleaner through the barrel of her pistol.
"Once they get on to a scent, there's no stopping them."
"We lost them at the fence-painting sequence in The Adventures of Tom Sawyer." "Tell them about the Perkins connection, Harris."
"I think that is Assumption Bellman, if you please," answered Tweed.
"Tell them,"
repeated the bellman, his shoulders sagging.
"I think everyone needs to know the full facts if we are to hunt Dean down."
"Very well." Tweed upended a box and deposited a huge quantity of full stops, commas, and semicolons onto the table.
"We found these hidden at the back of Dean's locker. We had them analysed and found traces of Guinness."
"Ulysses!" gasped Benedict.
"So it would appear," replied Tweed gravely. "Perkins mentioned something about a surprising discovery in a report filed the day before he died. We're working on the theory that Dean was involved in stealing or handling stolen punctuation.
Perkins finds out, so Dean releases the Minotaur and Virus to cover his tracks. Flushed with success and knowing he will have to vanish, he kills the maidservant, something he has been wanting to do since first publication."
"Isn't Perkins my investigation?"
asked Bradshaw.
"My apologies," replied Tweed. "I will give you a full copy of my report."
He stopped and sat down.
"I hate to say this," began the bellman sadly, "but it seems as though we have underestimated Dean. Until I am shown otherwise, I have no choice but to declare him a page runner. He is to be arrested on sight, and exercise extreme caution. If he is killed twice, he will not hesitate to kill again."
We exchanged anxious glances. Being declared a page runner was serious. Few were captured alive.
"Item 4, continued the bellman, "the Minotaur. We've got an APB on him at present, but until he turns up or does something stupid, we won't know where he is. There was a report he had crossed over into non-fiction, which I would love to believe. Until we know otherwise, everyone should keep a good lookout."
He consulted his clipboard again.
"Item 5, the 923rd Annual Book World Awards. Because we're launching Ultra Word at the same time, all serving members of the book world have been invited. Obviously, we can't leave books unmanned, so skeleton staff will be left in charge. The venue will be the Starlight Room again, although with the displacement field technology we've borrowed from the Sci-Fi Boys so everyone can attend. This will mean extra security, and I have allocated Falstaff to look after it. Any questions?"
There weren't, so he moved on.
"Item 6, Thursday next has been made a probationary jurisdiction member. Where are you?
I put up my hand.
Good. Let me be the first to welcome you to the service, and not before time. We need all the extra hands we can get. Ladies and gentlemen, Thursday next.
I smiled modestly as there was a round of applause. The people nearest me patted me on the arm.
Well done, said Tweed, who was close by, grinning. Miss Next will be afforded full rights and privileges, although she will remain under Miss Havisham's watchful eye for 20 chapters or a year, whichever be the longer. Will you take her up to the Council of Genres and have her sworn in?
Happily, replied Miss Havisham.
Good. Item 7. The had and that problem. Lady Cavendish, weren't you working on this?
Lady Cavendish stood up and gathered her thoughts.
Indeed. The uses of had and that have to be strictly controlled. They can interrupt the imagino-transference quite dramatically, causing readers to go back over the sentence in confusion, something we try to avoid.
Go on.
It's mostly an unlicensed usage problem. At the last count, David Copperfield alone had 63 times, all but 10 unapproved. Pilgrim's Progress may also be a problem due to its had/that ratio.
So what's the problem in progress?
That 10 times, but had only thrice. Increased had usage had to be overlooked, but not if the number exceeds that usage.
Hmm, said the bellman. I thought had TGC's approval for use in Dickens. What's the problem?
Take the first had and that in the book by way of example, explained Lady Cavendish. You would have thought that first had good occasion to be seen as had you not. Had approval, but had not. Equally, it is true to say that had approval, but that other that had not.
So the problem with that other that was that...
That other had approval.
Okay, said the bellman,
whose head was in danger of falling apart like a chocolate orange.
Let me get this straight.
David Copperfield, unlike Pilgrim's Progress, had
TGC's approval.
There was a very long pause.
Right, said the bellman with a sigh. That's it for the moment. I'll be giving out assignments in 10 minutes. Session's over. And let's be careful out there. Never would have thought it of Vernon, by George, exclaimed Bradshaw as he walked up. He was like a son to me.
I didn't know you had a son.
I don't, but if I did, he would be just like Vern.
His character in Potter News wasn't that pleasant, I observed.
We usually try and keep our book personalities separate from our jurisfiction ones, said Havisham.
Think yourself lucky I don't carry over any of my personality from Great Expectations. If I did, I'd be pretty intolerable.
Yes, I said diplomatically. I'm very grateful for it.
Ah, said the bellman as he joined us. Miss Havisham, you're to go and swear in Agent Next at the C of G, then get yourself to the well and see if you can find any clues inside the Squire of Hypotenuse. If possible, I want him alive. But take no risks.
Understood, replied Miss Havisham.
Good.
The bellman clapped his hands together and departed to talk to the Red Queen. Havisham beckoned me over to her desk and indicated for me to sit.
Firstly, congratulations on becoming a full jurisfiction agent. I'm not ready for this, I hissed. I'm probably going to fall flat on my face.
Probably has nothing to do with it. You shall. Failure concentrates the mind wonderfully. If you don't make mistakes, you're not trying hard enough.
I started to thank her for her faint praise, but she interrupted.
This is for you.
From the bottom drawer of her desk, she had withdrawn a small, green leather box of the sort that might contain a wedding ring. She passed it over and I opened it. As I did, I felt a flash of inspiration move through me. I knew what it was. No bigger than a grain of rice, it had value far in excess of its size.
From the last original idea,
murmured Havisham.
A small shard from when the hole was cleaved in 1884, but a part nonetheless. Use it wisely.
I can't accept this, I said, shutting the case.
Rubbish! Accept with good grace that which is given with good grace.
Thank you very much, Miss Havisham.
Don't mention it. Why do you have Landon written on your hand?
I looked at my hand but had no idea why. Gran had put it there. She must have been having one of her fuzzy moments.
I'm not sure, Miss Havisham. Then wash it off. It looks so vulgar. Come, let us adjourn to the Council of Genres. You are to sign the pledge.